All right, we are back on Motormouth Radio, and we're going to do this. We're going to push a few buttons, and we're going to say, hi, you're on with the Motormouths.
I'm on Motormouth?
Yes, Dan, you are on Motormouth Radio, yes.
Is this a prank call?
It, you know, we've been asked that before.
Mr. Dan Short, right? It's some are less pranky than others.
Yes, Mr. Dan Short, it's a very pleasure.
Hey, Dan.
The honor is all ours to have you on the show, Dan. We've been a fan of yours for quite a while, and it's a pleasure to speak with you.
Oh, actually, the honor is all mine. It's very cool. You know, I mean, if you really think about it, I got to tell you, I don't have that sort of philosophy that we should idolize anyone in Hollywood on TV or in movies or anything like that. So anytime someone wants to talk to me, I don't care if it's a homeless person or someone from a restaurant, I'll talk to anyone. So, you know,
that's cool.
I'm certainly no one to be considered having done anything significant. We got stuck doing a show for 6.5 years. That's it.
Actually, I was going to say, you talk to the right guys if you're talking about, you know, the homeless and the downtrodden. It's like, we're no elitists over here either, Dan. So, no, actually, just to divert from this, I'm more in awe of your past career, your military career. That's something that should be celebrated, and I think that's a great deal. That's a great thing. I come from a military family myself, so that's something that always had me... you know, that's tops in my list.
Well, thank you. And for what it's worth, my father, my grandfather, my great-great-grandfather, all the way back to the Crimean War, every male ancestor in that lineage has fought in war. And surprisingly enough, survived them all.
That's great. That's great.
Yeah.
And then you got to go to the war of TV... TV car shows.
How's that? Yeah, I did. And you know, I had a saying when people asked me, you know, was being in the military tough? Was it tough getting shot at or any of this other stuff? And the reality is that doing television is so much more brutal than being shot at. I'll go back and get shot at any time as a vacation.
Yeah, right. Oh, geez.
Yeah, a little bit stressful, I would say.
Well, says a lot. That being the case, Dan, did you seek out the TV deal, or did it come knocking on your door?
No, I am not mentally retarded. I am not. I do not have severe narcissistic tendencies. No, I actually wanted nothing to do with the show. I had a guy that dropped in one day, and he told me he was a potential customer. And I mean, I typically take a couple hours to talk to every potential customer. And after about 2 hours of giving him just straight truth, like when he would say, well, this should be easy, I'm like, yeah, you're crazier than hell. That's going to be impossible to do. And then he'd say, well, I know this is tough. And I go, actually, that's easy. You know, we can get those parts, and that's cheap and easy to do. And he realized after a couple of hours that I was probably telling him the truth about you know, just about everything. And he says, oh, we have to do a show here. And that's how it all started. I did not go looking for it.
You inspired him with your honesty and your straight-upness.
Well, yeah, I've discovered in life that if you ever, don't get me wrong, as a kid, you know, we've all told our little lies, you know what I mean? We got in trouble and we told our lies. But the simple fact is you're so much better off just telling people the truth.
It's a lot easier.
Especially if you're going to work on cars.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And that's what comes across, Dan, you know, ourselves included and our listeners. We watch pretty much most of all the car shows that are on TV, and we have our opinions, and we're really, really pretty much in line. And I know myself, I speak for myself, your show was one of the ones that I was drawn to like a moth, because I saw realism in you. You know, and in your guys, and I know that there's TV involved, so we don't know what's you know, the rest of it. We don't know, but we don't have to know, because if you can believe the host.
No, actually, that's a really good thing to just take 1 minute and talk about. Not one problem that was ever on our show was faked. Not one. Okay. We didn't have to. In fact, you know, people, I would get asked all the time, you know, were those did you really have all those problems? I'm like, no, we didn't have all those problems. We had eight times that many problems. We had to sort of call it down to a small list just to show what we dealt with. But not one time did we ever have any need, or did we fake a problem on the show. Never.
Right. So the writers didn't have to be busy with filling in the this is too boring. We got to spice this up a bit.
Yeah.
That's right. They didn't have to. In fact, if anything, the editors were far busier, you know, having to decide what to cut. Hey, we got seven issues on the car here we filmed, and we really only have enough film time on average for about three.
The reality of shop work.
They spent, each one of the shows took in the neighborhood of 100 hours of actual tape. Like
wow.
We created 100 hours of film for every 44-minute television show,
wow.
And each 100 hours took about 400 to 500 hours of work to get.
Oh, my God.
Surprising you got any work done there, getting cars fixed.
That is a question we want to breach. Like, yeah, how does things get done? You know, how does things really get done?
Well, I'm not going to tell you which executive, and I will say this in fairness, it wasn't at the network, which executive told me, you know, said, well, wait a second, we have a solution to the problem of, you know, getting cars done faster. Just hire a separate crew that works all night long and actually builds the cars, and that way your guys can just be on TV during the daytime acting. That was actually told to me, like, we should do that. And my first thought was, let me just choke the life out of this person who needs it.
Right.
But when I said, okay, well, beyond the fact that I can barely keep a crew going now because it's just so hard to find qualified mechanics,
right.
And beyond the fact that I'm already here about 17 hours virtually every day, who is going to be the new crew and who's going to manage them? She said, well, you just need to go find a new crew and you should manage them at night too.
Really?
Yeah,
seriously,
while you're home drinking your wine
and, you know, your white wine and crap. Yeah, get out of here.
Right.
Yeah,
so,
no, I don't think so.
The hours put into this were pretty obscene. I was either in front of a camera or working behind the scenes stuff, you know, between editing or like assistant directing and saying, no, you can't see what you're about to see from that angle. You need to see it from here. So I was very involved. I put about 30 hours a week, 51 weeks a year into the show. So I had roughly 1,500 hours a year just dedicated to creating the film.
Wow.
Holy crap.
Yeah.
And you're still standing. God bless you.
Yeah.
There were days I didn't feel like I was, I got to tell you. It was by far the most stressful period of my life, because not only was it the hours, it was the cost of doing it.
Sure.
All the overtime we spent, all the expectations that needed to be met. I mean, to talk about brutal. I mean, brutal, it doesn't even begin to deal with it. I'm not kidding. I would much rather get shot at than go back and do that same show under those same circumstances again. Getting shot at is easy.
I was going to say, it made me think of, like, those guys in other cultures that have, like, multiple wives. That'd be easier. You know?
And we're
all married guys here, so we're not making this stuff up.
Yeah.
Did you hear about that case recently? There was the guy that was found guilty of having two wives, and you know what his punishment was, right?
Well, keeping them both?
Two wives.
Yeah.
Oh,
so
I always used to say stuff like that is like having a sharp stick in both eyes.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So it was an interesting run, I got to tell you. But anybody who thinks that shooting a real show in a real shop is easy, their head is on backwards.
Well, yeah, seriously. I mean, just running a real shop, especially one of that caliber, can't be easy as it is. I mean, I'm sure it's like vacation time for you, you know, relatively speaking. But just running a regular shop, you know, shop regularly. I mean, I know my share of shop owners. I mean, and those guys are ripping their hair out just trying to get stuff done on a
That's the thing.
The usual stuff.
That's the thing, too, Dan. Is Joe and I don't own shops of our own now. Joe had to pass, but
I'm an ex-shop owner.
We both work in shops. steps. And so we see what it does take to get things done. What was your background in mechanics? How far back do you go? Do you go like us when you were a little kid, or was
This shouldn't be about the Dan Short Hour, so we don't want to talk too much about this, but probably like you, at the age of five, I was already ripping stuff apart, you know, that your mom yelled at you for.
Mm.
For me, I was fairly lucky. I was actually able to put most of it back together by the time I was about 7 or 8 years old.
Right.
I will tell one quick story. My single favorite thing that I remember doing was, I was somewhere in 7 or 8 years old, and I remember my mom throwing out her carpet shampooer.
Right.
And I said to her, "Why are you throwing that?" She goes, "Well, it doesn't work. You know, I turn the switch on, nothing happens." And I said, "Can I have it?" "Yeah, of course." So I pulled it apart with a screwdriver and a set of pliers. I looked through it, figured out what was wrong with it, repaired her shampooer, put it back together, and gave it back to her. And she was dumbfounded that, you know, this 8-year-old kid put her shampooer back together and made it work.
Nice.
Chances are, you know, Joe, Ray, you guys are the same way, right? You pull something apart, you can just sort of see how it goes back together.
Yeah, you have to have, it's a mindset,
I'll give you a perfect example. The problem I have is the repair by replacement way that people want us to do things now. Our teapot in the kitchen broke. You pull the lever and the spout wouldn't open up. So I said, we got to find a new teapot. Harder than you think to find a new teapot, by the way. But anyway, I said, let me look at this thing.
That's why God made coffee. Come on.
Well, so I bring it down to the workbench, and I look at it. I said, okay, there's roll pins. Take this. I got the thing apart. It was a plastic little arm that would push on another piece to open the thing, and it snapped. I said, okay, so you can't fix that. Grind it smooth, drill it, put in a wood screw, or I think I used a sheet metal screw, and replicated that plastic arm and said, voila, it's fixed.
Viola.
Yeah.
And my wife's like, how'd you do that? I'm like, don't ask. I can't tell you. It's like, it's a secret. But, you know, that's what we do.
And the shame of it is that that sort of an approach to problem solving is just disappearing today, isn't it?
Yeah, pretty much. I see quite a bit of it going away. Now it's, let's look it up online. Okay, it says that you've got this problem, you change that.
What's YouTube kind of say?
Yeah.
Wait a second. That's if they'll even do that. Wasn't that long ago, a guy about 35 years old pulled in right next to my office window, and it was on a Sunday, and I'm in here working, and I see the guy, and finally, after about half an hour, I decide to find out what's wrong. I knock on his window, and I said, is there something wrong? And he goes, yeah, I've got a flat tire. I didn't notice it was on the other side of his car. I said, well, don't you have a jack and a spare? And he said, yeah. And I said, okay, well, why don't you change your tire? He says, I have no idea how. Man was 35 years old and had no clue how to change his tire. That is not uncommon.
Yeah. it's kind of like the DIY is pretty much now the DIFM for me. Yeah,
right.
Yeah,
So the world is changing very rapidly. So, you know, for me, being able to find guys that not only know how to do this stuff, but even more importantly, can we all agree that fixing cars is not the most lucrative industry in the whole world?
Yes, we can.
Yeah.
Okay, so, you know, between the problems you run into, the logistics of finding the right parts, the parts arriving broken, getting them installed, not losing things, having comebacks and things like that. I mean, this is a brutal world to live in.
Yeah.
So not only is it tough to find the guys that do this, but then once you do, you got to be able to try and figure out how to pay them enough that they don't want to go do something else that's half as tough and pays twice as much.
Sure.
And so for me, what I work on every day is keeping these guys as inspired as I can and chasing passions and letting them sort of see these creations come through to fruition and then meeting the owners so that they can kind of see that they've changed someone's life. But I got to tell you, it's getting tougher and tougher to find the guys.
Yeah, everybody wants stuff handed to them. It's kind of tough to find people that'll fight through a problem, or especially what you guys do with the amount of fabrication and finding like obscure stuff.
Yeah,
you know what I mean. It's not like you could run down to the local Pet Boys or Advanced or whatever and find a tenth of what you need. You know what I mean? That stuff's got to get conjured up from God knows where.
I would say that we probably do, like, we do about $700,000-$800,000 a year just in parts.
Okay.
And of those 700,000 to 800,000, probably only about 100,000 come from within our city.
Okay.
All the rest are mailed in from either out of the state or out of the country.
Yeah. There's a guy at one of the local cruise nights I go to here on Long Island who had the guy that owns that the black 68 or 69 Chevelle that you did with the independent rear.
Yeah, Nick.
Yeah, he's at one of my local cruise nights. So we get to see your stuff. That's a gorgeous car.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to see your Camaro.
It's fast, too.
Yeah.
I had to learn a new term for Nick, septuagenarian.
Okay.
You know, and what that means is a 70-year-old dude that kicks your ass.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So
right.
He's very cool. Nick is just, he's like Clint Eastwood, you know, as far as I'm concerned.
Right. Cool stuff. You know, Dan, I was going to take a quick break, but I said, screw it. I'm going to keep going.
Yeah, really.
We got a great,
this is fun.
we got too good of a flow going to interrupt it. You know, I'm sure with all the negativity that we speak about and the downsides, there had to be some benefits from doing the show. What comes to your mind?
Yeah, one of the nice things is you get exposed to an entire new layer of humanity that there was no other way you could touch. It wasn't that long ago. My wife is on the phone, and you know, she walks in with this astonished look, and she says, "Ted Nugent would like to know if he can take you to lunch."
All right.
You know,
now
really,
now, what
you know, the
know
Motor
is-
City Madman. Yes. Right.
But in reality, and let's put this in perspective, was it the same feeling you had when they said, listen, yeah, Ray Guarino from Motormouth Radio wants to do an interview with you. Would you,
who?
Would you talk
it was
to
exactly
him?
The same.
Yeah, I'm
Ray,
sure
I,
it was.
Yeah, my skin was all tingling. You know, yep. It's very cool. Look, the fact that I'm on the phone with you guys today, right?
Yeah.
So doing a TV show itself is not necessarily enjoyable, but getting to meet, you know, you guys, getting to meet Bernie Kerik. I don't know, Bernie Kerik up in New York. He was the commissioner of police during 9/11, right?
Mm-hmm.
Asked by George Bush to be the director for Homeland Security. You know, I chat with Bernie Kerik on a regular basis.
Nice.
I have been up in D.C. and met with some of the most senior people. I'm knocking on the door of the White House at this point with some potential meetings with a couple folks inside the White House.
Nice.
Wow.
So, you know, it opened up entire horizons. And one more thing that I never even thought of. In doing television, hopefully you learn what's called the elements of story. And so as a result of understanding story, you know that there must be the three elements, which are hubris, nemesis, and catharsis. You know, desire, enemy, and then a resolution.
Mm-hmm.
And in learning that, I've started exploring my writing skills again, and I've actually just finished a novel. It's not quite out to the publisher yet, but I finished a novel that a lot of people believe is brilliant, and it's because I now understand stories. So the show really did open up amazing horizons.
You're quite the Renaissance man, aren't you?
Yeah.
That's kind of cool.
You know what they say, if you can't dazzle them with brilliance, baffle them with bullcrap, and I'm pretty good at that.
That's one of our mottos. That's on the coat of arms, the Motormouth coat of arms.
We do that every
week
here, too. Yeah, that's very cool. You know, going back to something you said before about, we're talking about parts and suppliers and things that don't get on here. There was a show a couple seasons ago, you guys had worked on a Volvo. I think it was a 39 Volvo. If I remember, it was like
30, that thing, yeah.
7, I think. 30, yeah, uh-huh.
And the water pump just kept leaking. Yeah, there was a big issue with that. And I said to myself as a viewer and fan, said, hey, you know, I know a guy who could fix that. And there's guys out here on Long Island that I actually... Joe's making a finger things, which is I'm doing the same thing. And I got in touch with them.
Not
and said,
that finger, right?
I said, hey, you guys would have been a natural for this. And they said, yeah, we did do that pump. and I said, well, how come there wasn't a credit for you guys? You know, and they said the production company basically didn't want that to be known. And I was really curious why, because...
Well, yeah, and that's a huge subject. Look, it's called product placement, and getting somebody's name on the show is much harder than you might think.
Mm-hmm.
When you look at some shows, like, for instance, you look at Graveyard Cars with Mark Werman,
mm-hmm.
They are allowed to have banners everywhere. If you watch that show, in fact, you're sort of inundated with sort of you know, background signs and things.
Right.
I don't know if you know ever realized it, but although my shop has hundreds of signs, every one of them are antiques and vintage,
yeah,
and none of them are from actual vendors.
That's a very good point. I was kind of noticing that, yeah. That's true.
Yeah, so
your shop doesn't look like the hood of a NASCAR car.
No.
Right, it doesn't.
And, that's great.
And you see, our show was considered kind of the sterile show or the virgin show when it came to product placement and advertisement. So on the good side, we were very genuine, and you never saw us holding up an intake manifold going, you know, this Edelbrock Performer intake, you know, provides great, you know, airflow and fuel atomization. You didn't hear us saying stuff like that, and that's part of what made us, I think, a little bit more legit in many ways. On the bad side, trying to help out, you know, little small businessmen with stuff was very difficult because the answer was just no for almost everything.
Yeah. No kidding.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. So, and it kind of sucked because, you know, it would have been neat to have had a whole lot more people. I mean, we had a lot of great people reach out and help us out. And unfortunately, we were just sort of told, you know, just do your show. And in fact,
Shut up and film.
Hang on. You will see in a couple of our shows there's signs that are blurred out.
Yes.
They're antique signs from companies that haven't existed in 50 years, and they still blurred them out because they said it looked like we were marketing.
Oh, boy. That's
really?
Yeah.
Oof.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, I know when they do it on a, you know, on a hat or a shirt or something. That we all understand. But, yeah, that's kind of ridiculous. But
it was a very clean show in terms of that sort of stuff. We basically didn't do any of that, and as a result, there was very, very little product placement or agreements that we were able to make. Best we could do is bring someone's product into our shop and do some stuff on, you know, social media. You know what I mean? A Facebook post or something like that. But basically, just about nothing made it onto the show.
It's good, though. It's good to see that you do have one of the coolest offices in the business because I always love looking at it. You know, I'm the guy that looks behind the focal point. I want to see, like, what's in the room or what's and I could look at your office all day. That's home.
Yeah.
Well, there's a lot. And believe it or not, they would redo my office almost every time because I had so much stuff they wanted to hide it. But the three coolest things in my office, I don't think you've ever seen. I have three of the original 1926 Route 66 road signs.
Uh-huh.
You know, and I mean, don't get me wrong, I don't have the world's greatest collection of Route 66 stuff, but I'm probably in the top five. And a lot of that never made the show, which I thought was a little sad because Route 66 is just sort of, you know, in that heart of America kind of thing.
Sure. Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's right. Something else I got, one of our listeners had asked me to put this out to you. I see it as a positive. He saw it as a negative. When you do your brake system tests on the danger drives that I like to call
danger drives.
Some people hate it. I said, man, that is great. Walk us through that. What was the impetus for doing that and for having that so prominent? Because it's become controversial.
Okay, right. You know, and the funny part was it got to the point where if a customer came here for a test drive and I didn't do it with them in the car, they would get very disappointed. I mean, all the customers wanted that. They you know, at first, I received a few letters like, you're some sort of a moron. You're flat-spotting the tires. Well, first of all, if that's enough to flat spot the tires, then they're not good tires anyway.
Right.
So I do it, and it's mostly I give the credit to my ex-wife. one day we were driving through a neighborhood, and actually she was behind the wheel, and I see this ball bouncing out, and she's driving a little too fast. She's probably doing 35, and a ball comes out between two cars, and I said, stop, and I screamed, and she finally hit the brakes, and she locked up the entire car just as this kid came out.
Wow.
And of course, the car rotated a little bit, you know, because a lot of them will go through a sort of a phase gyration.
Right. Yep.
And so I want to know if a car has any really untoward reactions when you hit the brakes hard. And by the way, that's my third brake test that you see. That's the one the camera always loved. the lead-in brake tests, which aren't anywhere near as aggressive, they weren't as camera worthy.
Phase one, phase two.
What that does is, if I have a car that has funny reactions under a panic stop, number one, I'm going to work to get rid of it. And in only one case, I couldn't get rid of it, in which case I brought the driver of the vehicle out, and I said, I'm going to take you through it so that if you ever have this situation, you know what to do. Because his car would rotate about 40 degrees at 35 to 45 miles an hour. It would just rotate, and you could not stop it from that rotation. And so, you know, you need people to understand in an emergency what the car is going to do. I took a lot of flack for that, but I still do it to every car.
I mean, if you're going to have a performance car like that, you really should know what it's capable of, what kind of stunts it's capable of pulling. You know what I mean? I always see people driving cars, you know, these nice cars around like they're old ladies and stuff. I'm like, that's kind of like dating Scarlett Johansson playing Pinochle.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's like, come on, you got to pound it.
and you know that's very common. Most people that we build cars for, especially those that say, I want lots of horsepower, they have no clue how to drive their vehicle.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and what you don't see on the show, I think you've only seen it like two or three times, but I do this very regularly. Any performance car we build for a customer, I take them out for kind of one of those, you know, Richard Petty experiences, and take them through how their car drifts, how their car rotates sideways through a turn. I do that with most of my customers.
You got to shake it down.
Yeah, it's good.
Oh, hell yeah, because you don't want to find out it failed the first time they tried it. If it's going to fail, I want it to fail on me.
And it's good that you're in an area, you know, where you can do that. You have a somewhat, we see you go.
Try that in Queens.
Well, we see you go from the industrial area.
Wait
into
a second.
Yeah.
You know, that's a highly, look, I'm in the middle of a big city.
Right.
So as I do this stuff, and I can only say so much, I have had several of the constables let me go. I have had some of the constables talk to me, and on a few occasions, I may have even gotten away.
Well, yeah, we figure when you see you driving a car with no doors, no windshield, no license plates, we figure someone knows what you're doing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They,
So that's been an interesting ongoing relationship with the police. I will tell you that they're very decent. The police officers in Norfolk have treated us very, very well. And don't get me wrong, we don't do anything stupid that would endanger someone other than like me and the car. You know what I mean?
Right. Sure.
Yeah. Well, you know where to draw the line.
Yeah. Dad, I got to tell you, I have a bunch of questions here. We're not going to get through them. I think we're going to have to have you back.
The way that we're flying here,
For round two. But one of the things I wanted to ask, and this was like the elephant that I wanted to drop, but I don't know if we can even. Yeah, well, it wasn't a Hemi though. The real cost of car restorations. Can you encapsulate that for us?
Let me give you a couple examples.
Please do.
Because, you know, look, I think still to this date I'm the only guy on TV that's ever talked real honest numbers about what it costs to do this. And the irony is we're not a really expensive shop. Like, people write me, like, I know you're, like, super expensive. And it's like, you're crazier than hell. We're not at all. We just brought a vehicle in here from another shop that they spent just about $400,000 on, and they brought it for us to finish it.
Wow.
In fact, it came out of New York.
Uh-huh.
No kidding.
So we you know, my full build on these muscle cars was anywhere ranging from about $150,000 to $200,000. And I mean, I would see audiences, especially women, gasp as I would say that. And I got to tell you, we were barely breaking even building the cars for those kind of numbers.
Wow.
The fact is to go through a car, every part, build it, build the engine bay, build the bottom of the car, the steering, the suspension, the wiring, the brakes, the window regulators, the dash, the gauges, the seats, and a thousand other things.
It adds up quick.
It's, it's virtually impossible to do that in less than about 1,500 to 2,000 hours. I mean, it's just, you know, I haven't found the crew anywhere in the world capable of doing it.
Yeah.
And then it isn't unusual at all for us to drop 50 grand in materials. You know, people say, well, why can't you do a paint job for $1,000? My average paints cost $4,000.
Right.
Yeah.
Sure, sure.
You know, so the reality is, when we were building cars and you saw the ones that we built on TV and we talk numbers, in most of those cases, if the number was greater than $100,000, I had lost money on the build.
Wow.
Whoa.
And so this is an expensive thing to do. And every single person before they step out of this building on the first day knows what their car is going to cost, and in virtually every case, we come in under the budget that we agree to.
That's great. And that was one of the things that I know I liked, and other people have expressed they like as well.
That's refreshing.
Is when you brought people in, you know, before they picked the car up, and you give them that stack of paper, and you go through the labor rate, the hours and the parts, and you break it down. I mean, that's real life. That's what you're going to get. You know, you're not going to just, the big reveal isn't always, you know, like the Wizard of Oz, let's face it. You know,
so exactly.
There's a price tag.
And the first meeting that you saw on TV that was actually about, you know, 1 to 2 minutes on television, that in virtually every case was in excess of 8 hours of work to get to that 1 or 2 minutes that you see on TV. Because you don't show all of, you know, that how the sausage is made, so to speak.
Sure.
But the reality is we would talk about everything. Sometimes the camera would get it, sometimes they wouldn't. It was always edited way, way down.
Mm-hmm.
But no customer has ever really been surprised, you know, at the final bill. They're just not.
Yeah, that's good to know. That's very good to know. You know, we have a good friend, Matt Goman Brian. He's down in Delaware, and he wants to know, whatever happened to the purple wide-body 67 Corvette? We've had a few people ask us about that. They said, you got to ask Dan. Okay, I will.
Well, and I only know rumors, but I will inform you of the rumors. One of my guys here, who shortly after that car left, was asked to leave, and I suspect they might have been doing a little bit of, there might have been a few conversations behind the scenes between the owner of the car and that individual, and that car was brought to a shop that they were setting up to finish it. Now, what the crazy part was is we were actually under budget on that car, and we were probably only 90 days from finishing it.
Oh, wow.
But the relationship had become difficult enough that I felt it was probably and when the owner said, you know, I'm going to go ahead and remove my car, I said, you know,
yeah.
Okay.
We will have it packed up and ready for
don't
you.
Don't let the door hit you in the ass. That's good.
Well, you know, the reality is there was an article in Hemmings several years back where Hemmings claimed that about 95% of the cars that go into a restoration shop do not get finished by that by the one restoration shop.
Mm-hmm.
That cars routinely, like 19 out of 20, will end up going from shop to shop to shop.
Wow.
And we've got an in excess of 99.9% completion rate on every car that's ever come in here.
Nice.
We've only had, I think, out of 5,500 cars, we've had about 4 leave here unfinished, and that was one of the 4.
Okay, that's a great rate.
That's a good batting average, that's for sure.
Absolutely. Dan, do you remember?
Not one of them have I kicked out. Every one of them. Okay. You see, I can't legally kick them out because it's breach of contract.
Right.
So I'm not going to tell you that I haven't encouraged a few owners to find somebody else to build their car when things get difficult enough, but I've never quit on a car. It's always been the owner.
Do you remember what episode of what season that car was portrayed in? Because I was asked about that, too, and I didn't recall.
Oh, no, I don't memorize those kind of numbers, but that would have been, You see, because I think the network called my last season season 9. So
yeah.
If the last season was 9, that probably would have been in 7, either 7 or 8.
Right. Okay. Good. That's that handles that. That's excellent.
And look, wait a second. You guys work on cars. Let me ask you.
Mm-hmm.
How many customers have, and we'll assume the number is zero, but would that be correct that you have never had a customer ever upset with anything you've done on a car?
No, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Forget.
We wish.
Don't damn. Well, not on this planet.
You know, we call it here, Dan, we have a decoder on our website under the blogs. We call it the Sinju syndrome.
Everett Sinju.
Right. And what that means is when you work on a guy's transmission, and then the guy comes back in a week or the woman, and she's complaining that, you know, now the brake's locked up. And what do you mean? Well, since you worked on my transmission, my brake's locked up. Well, we didn't touch your brakes.
Since you fixed my taillight, I got a flat.
Exactly.
Come on.
Yeah. I was asked, because of my reputation, I was asked to testify for a guy who goes, the shop down the road screwed up my air conditioning. I said, well, what did they do to your air conditioning? And when did they do it? He goes, well, they worked on my car June of last year. So that would have been almost 18 months earlier. And I said, what did they do? He said, well, they did a brake job.
Nah.
And I said, wait a second. You want me to go to court to testify against them because your air conditioning stopped a month ago? He goes, well, yeah. And I said, did they bill you even a penny for your air conditioning? No. I said, do your brakes that they billed you for still work? He said, yeah. I said, so everything they billed you for is great, and you want to sue them for something they never touched? Well, yeah, but they were the last guys to work on my car.
Oh, yeah.
And you want to choke these people to death, don't you?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Please. Absolutely.
Because it's like, can you really be that stupid that you think that just because it rolled into their shop, that a year and a half later, an unrelated problem with your car is their fault? But they do. They really think it's your fault.
Right.
Yeah, because you touched it. It's like, you know, I just had a state inspection, and now, you know, like a month ago, and now my motor blew. I'm like, yeah, and?
Right. Yeah. You put windshield wipers on my car. I need a new engine now. Oh, it's crazy, and we run into that too. Now, one of the things that I do, and in fact, that's what I've been here all morning doing, is I write contracts now for people where I basically say, if you're one of those guys, we're not building you a car, and you have to agree that things that we don't touch, you're not going to complain about.
Right.
And if they don't sign that, then I don't touch their car. So
good idea.
And by the way, that's one of the other good benefits of the show is, you know, we have almost 4,000 people in line trying to get into the shop now.
Wow.
And so, yeah, the good news about having 4,000 people is, anybody who asks you to do something crazy or says, well, I want to reuse my old gas tank that's rusted out because I want to save money, you can just go, you know what, maybe I'm not the right job.
Next.
Yeah, seriously.
Yeah.
No destination for you.
Dan, I have to tell you, we're almost at the end of our hour. We're going to have to run and take care
of
some business.
Yeah. There's so many more other things we want to talk about.
Can we get you to come back in a future date and pick this up? Because where we left
off. Wait. I don't like talking much, guys. You probably figured that out in the last 45 minutes, right?
Yeah, and we're called Motor Mouse because we're mutes. Yeah, I know.
Yeah. Okay. I'd be honored to come back. This is a lot of fun. You guys are a lot of fun to talk to. So, yeah, anytime.
Excellent. I'll be in touch, and we'll put that together. We'll give it a couple weeks, and we'll pick this back up, and I'm sure we're going to get some good listener response. So
we're going to get feedback about this, that's for sure.
All right.
Guys, it's been delightful. Look, you have a great weekend, and we'll talk to you soon.
Thanks,
Dan. Thanks, man.
We'll talk to you again soon. Thanks. Bye-bye.
Yep.